All right, so with that, it's time for me to say, as I probably always do, turn with me, if you will, to where this week's Torah portion begins. It's Genesis chapter 32, not at the very beginning of the chapter, but fairly shortly thereafter. As you remember, last time we have Yaakov, his four wives, and his 12 sons, and his daughter, and all of his sheep and goats and cattle and camels and everything else heading up and moving on out. They have the encounter with Laban, and following that, it's time for Yaakov to, after a journey, be preparing to meet his brother. And so that's how this one begins. Vayishlach, it says. First word in the portion. Vayishlach Yaakov. That means he sent, right? Remember shalach? We know that word. It's the word that's used to send out. So when a man sends away a wife, that's the precursor to the process of divorce, first step, send out. So there's the root word shalach in there that you recognize. And in this case, and vayishlach, and sent Yaakov messengers out before him to Esau his brother, the land of Seir, in the field of Edom. Now, at this point, let me just kind of introduce the where we're headed this week with a couple of reminders. Remember when his mom, Rivka, said, hey, you know, after Esau cools off, I'll send for you? Well, that's been 22 years ago, and he ain't heard nothing yet. So presumably, even though you would hope that time would heal some wounds, it doesn't sound like we have any indication that, well, she's ever sent for him. So Yaakov does something which seems fairly wise, Hachom here. He commands him, saying, look, here's what you're going to say to my brother and my lord Esau. And here comes the quote. Thus says your servant Yaakov, Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban. I've been there up until now, and I have a lot of stuff. I got oxen and asses and flocks, men servants and maidservants, and I have sent to tell my lord that I might find favor in your sight. So that sounds like a nice introduction. He's hoping for the best. He's making a really nice offer to his brother. And they go out, and then they come back, and they say the following. Look, we went to your brother, and moreover, he is coming to meet you. There's the good news and the bad news, right? Bad news, he's got 400 men with him. So that sounds like probably worse news than he might have been hoping for. And then we have verse 8. Now this is probably the single verse in the entire Parsha here that attracts the most attention and gets the most discussion. And of course it's one that I'm going to at least spend a minute or two on and mention. It says here something which sounds redundant. Matter of fact, in English it's almost very redundant. We are reminded, of course, that there's no idle word in Torah. So when we see something like this, it kind of should stand out. We say, okay, what's it really saying? Yaakov, it says, was greatly afraid, and he was distressed. Say what? Is greatly afraid and distressed. Isn't that a bit redundant? He divided the people that were with him, the flocks, the herds, and the camels. In other words, he split himself into two camps. And we're going to see, at least as a metaphor, this appears over and over again. Of course, we have the two wives, the two kingdoms, the split that happens literally among the sons of Israel, among the 12 tribes, centuries later as well, where they're split into two camps. He does it in this case for an insurance policy. Because he says, if Esau comes to one camp and smites it, well, then perhaps the other one, which is left, shall escape. So he has a military, if you will, an understandable reason for saying, the line of the promise is through me. Even if he kills one of the camps, perhaps the other one will survive. Now, he is going to pray, but I want to stop and look at verse 8 again, since I mentioned this. Greatly afraid and distressed. Now, the Midrash, and I think this is a pretty cogent understanding, says, well, when you see that, think in terms of maybe there's something more to it. So, one of the things that kind of makes sense is this idea of more than one reason. He could be very afraid, greatly afraid, on a physical level, right? Afraid of the obvious, afraid of dying. What's the distress, though? And essentially, the commentaries imply there is a moral fear here as well. Because it's one thing to fear dying, it's another thing to fear killing. he is perhaps getting ready to enter into battle. And I have to believe he doesn't want to kill his brother Esau. He doesn't want to die either. And if he has to, he seems to be prepared to kill Esau, perhaps to kill a whole bunch of those men in order to have the family survive. But that's not a pleasant proposition. And, of course, here comes the whole lot of discussion, and we'll kind of gloss over it. We may spend some more time talking about it tomorrow. But when it comes to the moral anxiety, no doubt about it, if there is, in fact, a fear for his life, if Esau really does intend to kill him, he would be, if you will, morally justified in taking lives in order to defend his and his family. No problem there. But you know what? Even if that is right, both scripturally and morally, to defend your life and to kill if necessary to do so. And there's a lot of discussion about, you know, can you just maim? How much does it take in order to get people to quit fighting and decide that, you know, if you're a mercenary, go home? Here's the key. Right, to be morally right, does not mean that the whole thing is painless. If he had to kill Yaakov, no doubt, that would be a very painful, very difficult to deal with situation. So I can understand why he would be both physically afraid and morally anxious. Even if he knows what he's doing is right, doesn't mean you necessarily want to do it. Now, one other comment on this, I guess. We've just been told that the messengers come back and they say, look, your brother's got 400 men with him. And since we're thinking about it, if we see numbers in Scripture and they seem like numbers we've seen before, it at least is worth pointing out. We're told, we've already seen this number once because Abraham was told, your children's children's children are going to sojourn in a land, basically in bondage, for 400 years. And furthermore, we know one other place, at least, where that number 400 appears. That was the price, the exorbitant price even, 400 shekels of silver that Father Abraham purchased the burial plot there in the field in the cave of Machpelah for. So somehow or other, this number 400 is now appearing for the third time. All right, so Yaakov has split the camp. And then he prays, and he says, O Elohim of my father Abraham, Elohim of my father Isaac, and in this case it's Elohi, it's my, right? Yahuwah, who said unto me, return to your country and your kin, and I will do you good. Pause there. This is another one of those places where we see a reference in Scripture, and I always like to think, how is it that the men that were true men of Yah, how did they pray? Well, one of the things that they will do is they will remind the Creator of His promises. And in the process, I think we remind ourselves of those promises. So I have always found this to be a good example that they have set and a good reminder for us, and it's a wonderful metaphor. We can stand on His promises. Yes, we remind him, but more importantly, we do remind ourselves that they are his promises, and that's what we need to remember. That ought to be sufficient, because he will, in fact, keep his word. We do need to make sure, if we're going to be reminded of these things, that we are doing the preconditions, in other words, that we're walking in such a way that we can stand on those promises. In this case, the promise, return to your country and your kin, and I will do you good. So Yaakov continues. He says, you know, I'm not worthy of all the mercies, all the truth that you've shown unto your servant. For with my staff I passed over this river Jordan, and now look what's happened. I have become two camps. So he continues, deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, because I do fear him, lest he come and smite me, the mother with the children. And here he reminds him again, you said, I will surely do you good, and make your seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. So he tarried there, he lodged there that night, and he took of that which he had with him a present for Esau his brother. As a matter of fact, this is a pretty significant, sizable present. It lists it in the next few verses. 200 she-goats and 20 he-goats. 200 ewes and 20 rams. So 200 sheep, both females, ewes and she-goats, and 20 each. He-goats and rams. Now, I've always found that interesting. Now that I have sheep, it's not sheep. We have goats, not nearly that many, but the ratio is kind of telling, isn't it? The she-goats and the she-sheep seem to be a lot more valuable than the he-goats. Doesn't take but one he-goat to perform his he-goaty duties for a whole lot of females. In other words, to keep the line propagated. But it's the sheep, it's the females rather, that provide all the good stuff in terms of being able to bear more children and also milk and the like. Makes sense. All right, he's not done though. He's got more here. 30 milk camels and their colts, 40 kine and 10 bulls. Still more females than males. 20 she asses and 10 foals. And he delivered all of these to the hand of his servants and drove them all kind of independently. And he said to these folks, pass over before me. Put some space between you and the next camp or the next drove. And then he commanded the first in line, saying, look, when my brother Esau meets you and he asks you, saying, whoa, whose are you and where are you headed? And whose are all of these before you? Here's what you're to tell him. These are my servant Yaakov. These are your servant Yaakov's. In other words, he, your brother Yaakov, your servant, these are his. But these are a present sent unto my Lord, even unto Esau. Behold, he is somewhere back there coming up. He's behind us. And he commanded the second and the third and all that followed in the various droves, saying, in this manner you will speak to Esau when you find him. And here's what you're going to say. Moreover, your servant Jacob is behind us. For he thought and said, perhaps I will appease him with the present that goes before me, and afterwards I'll see his face. Perhaps, peradventure, he will accept me. Maybe his anger will be assuaged, and maybe there can be reconciliation here. So the present passed over before him. Meanwhile, he himself lodged that night in the camp. So Yaakov is going to spend another night in the camp, and he rose up that night. He took his two wives and his two handmaids, Shif Katin, and his 11 children, and he passed over the ford of the Yabbok. He took them, he sent them over the stream, and he sent over that which he had. And here is now Jacob, Yaakov, finally left alone. Here comes the famous wrestling match. He wrestled with an ish until the breaking of the day. And when he saw that that he did not prevail against him, the ish, the man, the arguably messenger, finally touched the hollow of his thigh, which was strained as he wrestled with him. And he said, let me go, for the day is breaking. Nope, says Yaakov, I will not let you go except and unless you bless me. Well, he's asked, what's your name? Well, answered, Yaakov. And he says, your name shall no longer be called Yaakov, but Israel. For you have striven with Elohim and with men, and you have prevailed. Well, Yaakov asked him, tell me, I pray, what's your name? Why are you asking? And he blessed him there. He didn't answer, it doesn't seem. So Yaakov called the name of that place Peniel, for I have seen the face of El, and indeed my life is preserved. And the next verse tells us, now this is always kind of interesting too. I enjoy looking at the Hebrew words, as you know. Occasionally there are some things that kind of stand out in the Hebrew you wouldn't notice at all in the English. The sun rose upon him, it says, as he passed over Peniel, and he limped upon his thigh. In this case, that word there that's translated as sun is ha-shemesh. And if you think about it, anybody remember the Hanukkah candles, the servant candle, right? It's called the shemesh. Same root word, at least, that means servant. So he limps. This is why verse 33 tells us the children of Israel to this day don't eat the sinew of the thigh vein upon the hollow of the thigh, because he, meaning this ish, touched the hollow of Yaakov's thigh, the sinew of the thigh vein. So here comes Yaakov. He lifts up his eyes, and from afar, look, here is his brother Esau coming, along with his 400 men. Now, he divided the children unto Leah and unto Rachel and unto the two handmaids. So each of them have a group of children with them. He put the handmaids and the children foremost. He put Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Yosef. Rachel and her only son, Joseph, were at the back, the hindmost. And he himself, Yaakov, passed over before all of them. He bowed himself to the ground 7 times as he came near his brother. And Esau runs up to meet him and embraced him and fell upon his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Now, let's pause here again, too. This is another one of those places where you see something interesting in the Hebrew, and it doesn't translate into the English. As a matter of fact, it's not even in the English. But the words there that say, and kissed him, have, this is probably the most famous, if you will, in the Torah, of what's called the jots and the tittles. The dots, the jots. These are four dots that are put over the top of the Hebrew words, and kissed him. And they wept. Now, what does that mean? There is much discussion, as you might figure on this point. One of the things that the scribes will say is that when the dots are there, maybe that means we're not sure about this. Or maybe that means you can ignore these words or something. Or maybe it's a special emphasis. As you might guess, there is at least some disagreement as to what they really mean. One thing's for sure, they're emphasized. So after all of this buildup, step back and look at it. What do we got? The two brothers meet after 22 years, after a whole lot of presents, after some supplication, after Yaakov literally making clear that he's a changed man. And he is going to come before his brother subserviently. Esau runs to meet him, embraced him, fell upon his neck, and kissed him. So the one thing's for sure is there's some kind of emphasis here, and it's perhaps a bit surprising. And they certainly wept together. Now, there is a bit more speculation. Probably most of you have heard this, but if you haven't, I'll at least mention it. And kissed him. What does that mean? Is it a sincere kiss, or is it insincere? Is it ambivalent, perhaps? So all of those things are considered as possible explanations for what the jots above and kissed him might mean. There's even a midrash. Now, I'm not as wild about this one because it does tend to be more than a bit speculative, but you've probably heard it if you haven't. And you read some of the background, you'll probably see it in there. Oh, maybe this was like a vampire thing. Okay, I don't buy it. Like I said, let me emphasize that. Esau was going to bite him on the neck, but his neck was turned to stone, say some of the claims, and he couldn't. So for whatever reason, in any case, we have these four dots, and he kissed him, and they wept. So regardless of exactly what might be going on in Esau's head and in Yaakov's head, they clearly wept. This was clearly a very big deal, an emotional reunion, no battle, and that's a very good thing, and we see the emphasis. And it does look like there is indeed some genuine reconciliation here, even though there may not be complete trust at this point. Okay, so here's a comment. Let me see here. Rico and I read a very interesting take on Taste of Torah Devotional, that the man Yaakov wrestled with is thought to be speculated Esau's guardian angel. Okay. Honestly, I ain't never heard that one either. So, who knows? So Esau's guardian angel would have renamed him. That certainly is interesting, too. I guess it's probably worthy of some consideration. Like I said, it's the first time I've heard that, so maybe so. But yeah, it is interesting. And that's one of the things about, looking at the Torah and studying it. When the Torah is... doesn't give us enough information. We do have this tendency. It's kind of a natural tendency to speculate a bit, to think about it, to see what makes sense. I often remark that each time I go through it, and it depends, as we mature, as we learn things, as we get older, or as we see things in the world, occasionally we will have a slightly different reaction. We'll think something that didn't seem plausible, a few Torah cycles ago, all of a sudden seems really understandable. So I think for that reason, it's one of the great blessings of going through the Torah over and over again, is that we get new insight, and we'll see things that maybe we hadn't thought of before, and they do kind of resonate on different levels. So back to Esau. He lifts up his eyes, he sees all the women and children, he says, who are these with you? Well, the response, the children whom Elohim has graciously given your servant. So the handmaids, Bilhah and Zilpah, they come near first, they and their children, and they bow down. And then comes Leah and her children, they came near, they bowed down. Finally, Joseph and Rachel, and they all bowed down. Well, he says, what do you mean by all this camp which I met? Well, the answer is, this is to find favor in the sight of my Lord. Well, says Esau, I have enough, my brother. let that which you have be yours. No, no, says Yaakov, I pray you, if I have now found favor in your sight, then please receive my present at my hand. For as much as I've seen your face, as one sees the face of Elohim, and you were pleased with me. In other words, this is a great blessing. I am thankful and I'm thrilled to provide this to you. So he says, take, I pray, et bar kati. Birkati. Right? We recognize that name. Baruch, right? That's the same root word in there, Baruch. That's the word that means blessing. So it's translated as take, I pray, my gift, my present. But I do think it's important to understand what it really is here is take my blessing that is brought to you. Now think of it in the context. This is why I emphasize this. Think of it in the context of what it was that this very same Esau accused Yaakov of stealing. You took my blessing. Here he says, take my blessing that is brought to you, because Elohim has dealt graciously with me and because I have enough. And now he urged him, and for whatever reason at this point, and I can think of several, but maybe this resonates with Esau too. He does take it. And all right, they said, let's take our journey. Let's go, and I'll go before you. Well, the response comes from Yaakov. My Lord knows the children are, you know, they're young. This is a tough trip for them. And the flocks and herds that are giving suck, they got youngins. These are a care to me. And if we overdrive them too much, the flocks will die. So, you know, if it's all right with you, I pray, pass over first. You go ahead. And I will journey on a bit more gently. We'll take our time according to the pace of the cattle that are before me and according to the peace and the pace of the children until I come to you, unto my Lord in Seir. And Esau says, all right, let me now leave with some of the folk that are with me. And what do you need? If I have found favor in the sight of my Lord, this is good. So Esau returned that day, headed up towards his place in Seir. And Yaakov, instead, he journeyed to Sukkot. He built a house there. He made booths. There's the same root word, right? Sukkot, for his cattle. And guess what? That's why they call the name of the place Sukkot. And then he came in peace to a city that we're going to remember this name, Shechem, in the land of Canaan. And he came from Paddan Aram, and he encamped there before the city. He brought he bought the parcel of ground where he'd spread his tent at the hand of the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money, no, silver, kesef. So he paid a pretty good price for the land. He bought it from the children of Hamor, father of Shechem, and this is the place that is named after that man. And once he did that, he erected an altar. He called it El Elohei Israel. Now remember, he's been told, your name is going to be Israel. So, we have a shift in the narrative, a whole different story. This one is a fairly, in a way, tragic, certainly an emotional story. It's going to have a lot to do with a number of things that are going to resonate literally through the centuries. And it has to do with Dinah, daughter of Leah, the one that she had born unto Yaakov, the sole daughter in this group here at this point for sure. And she, it says, went out to see the daughters of the land. She went out to see the daughters of the land. You'll hear a lot of speculation. What was really going on here? Is she just looking to get into trouble? Is she doing something that's unwise? You know, she's just a young girl and going to get herself in a whole heap of trouble. You know, no shortage of speculation, but for whatever reason, she does. She heads out and bad things happen. Shechem, son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the land, saw her and he lachak her. He took her. And that means you know what. Was it rape? Was it voluntary? We're not given enough information to know for sure, but we at least understand Dinah should have known better. Let me say that again. Dinah should have known better. I know she was taught better. So given that situation, there was at least some, let's just say, persuasive coercion or more that goes on here. He lay with her, and it says he humbled her. Anah is the root word there. To defile or afflict, and that we know exactly what the reference is. Now, at this point, though, his soul cleaves to Dinah, daughter of Yaakov. He loved her, it says, and he spoke comfortingly to her. Right? I'll respect you in the morning. Shechem then goes to his father, good old Hamor, and he says, give me this woman to wife. Here the plot thickens. Yaakov hears that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Did Dinah tell him? Did word get back? We're not told. But clearly, if you note the way that it is explained, Yaakov heard what? Dinah has been defiled. His sons were with his cattle in the field. Yaakov held his peace. He kept his mouth shut till they got home. Meanwhile, Hamor, father of Shechem, goes out to see Jacob, speak with him. Sons of Yaakov came in from the field when they heard this whole thing. Want to see what dad's going to do. The men were pretty upset. They were, as a matter of fact, they were grieved, it says, very wroth, angry. And you get this picture, right, of the bull with the nose flaring. They were angry because he had done a vile deed in Israel by lying with Yaakov's formerly virgin daughter, that which ought not to be done. As if there was any doubt, it's now very clear. This was not a good thing. He shouldn't ought to have done this. So Hamor spoke with him, said, look, you know the soul of my son Shechem? He longs for your daughter. You've got a real nice soft spot for her. I pray that you will give her to him as a wife. And you can make marriages with us, too. Hey, this is the start of something great, man. Think of it that way. You can give your daughters to us, take our daughters unto you. You dwell with us. The land will be before you. Dwell, trade herein, get your possessions herein. This will be a great deal for all concerned. Shechem says to his father and unto Dinah's brothers, let me find favor in your eyes. And what you say unto me, that's what I will give. So he is, you know, is there a bride price here? Whatever it is, I'll take care of that. I will pay it. Ask me ever so much dowry and gift, and I'll give whatever you tell me. But just give me the woman to be my wife. Well, it says here, verse 13, the sons of Yaakov, doesn't say Jacob, no. The sons of Yaakov answered Shechem and Hamor, his father, with guile. They lied. And they spoke because he had defiled Dinah, their sister, and he said to them, we can't do this thing to give our sister to someone who is uncircumcised. That's just not going to happen. For that would be a reproach unto this. So, there's only one way this could possibly work, this condition. If you will be as we are, and every single male among you, the whole lot, get circumcised, well, then we'll give our daughters to you, we'll take your daughters to us, we'll dwell with you, we'll become one people. Am Echad. But if you will not hearken to us, if you won't get circumcised, all right, sorry, Charlie, we'll be out of here. We'll take Dinah and we will be gone. Now, it says in the next verse that these words pleased Hamor, Shechem, Hamor's sons. They're thinking, that's a pretty good deal. We can go with that. So the young men decided they were going to go ahead and go with it. They did not. They didn't hesitate to do this thing. Because he, meaning Shechem, had delight in Yaakov's daughter. He was honored above all the house of his father. They seemed to have held Shechem in pretty high regard. So Hamor and Shechem, his son, they came to the gate of the city. They spoke with the entire city, all the men, and they said the following. These are peaceable folk, so let's let them dwell in the land, trade here. Behold, the land is large enough for all of us. Let's take their daughters to us for wives. We'll give them our daughters. And here is the catch, guys. This is the only condition that they will consent to dwell with us, to become one people. If every male among us be circumcised as they're circumcised. You want us to what? Yeah. And it sounds like they basically are fine with that. Look, he said, continuing, shall not their cattle and their substance and all their beasts be ours? Just let us consent to them, this one thing, and they will dwell with us. So, unto Hamor and Shechem, his son, all of the men that went out of the gate of the city hearkened. They heard and they obeyed. Every male was circumcised, all that went out of the gate of the city. Wow. Now, having not been circumcised as an adult, but having read things like this, I'm always a little bit amazed when I read this next verse. Because it sounds like the recovery period from an adult circumcision is a lot longer than it is for a baby boy. on a number of fronts. And it's not like these guys are going to go out and run a marathon or do a whole lot of physical labor or squat thrusts or anything of the sort for several days. Turns out that on the third day even, when I was hiking and doing a lot of physical workouts, I always had the understanding it was usually the second day where the pain peaks. But clearly with circumcision, seems to be a bit longer. And it sounds like the sons of Yaakov knew this. So here we are. On the third day, they were in pain. The two of the sons of Yaakov, Simeon and Levi, brothers of Dinah, took their swords and they came into the city unaware. And they slew every single male in Shechem. And they killed Hamor and Shechem his son too with the edge of the sword. They took Dinah out of Shechem's house and they went forward. And by the way, that root word there, I usually remark on this too. The edge of the sword. Lefi cherev. Lefi cherev. The edge of the sword. Generally, when we see the edge of the sword, the mouth of the sword is the literal translation there. It's a reference to how the sword devours the pagans. So they got Dinah, and they went out. Sons of Yaakov, the rest of them, it sounds like, came upon the slain. They spoiled the city because they had defiled their sister. Now, is this all of them, or is it just the two? It's not clear. We know that later it's Yaakov going to blame those two for having instigated the dirty deed, but there may have been more commiseration here at this point. Because what they said is they did this because he had made Tamei, Shechem, and the city, had made Tamei, had defiled, made profane their sister. And they not only spoiled the city, they took a whole lot of stuff. They took their flocks, they took their herds, they took their asses, they took that which was in the city, that which was in the field, all of their wealth, their little ones, their wives, they took all of them captive, even all that was in the house. Now, Yaakov, as you might suspect here, he is not happy about this in the least. He said to Simeon and to Levi, "You have troubled me. You have made me literally odious." Ish unto the inhabitants of the land, even to the Canaanites, the Perizzites, and I am not very many in number, right? It's just us, guys. They'll gather themselves together against me and smite me, and I'll be destroyed, me and our whole house here. He is not happy. He is telling the boys, the young men, you have done something which, in fact, may get us all killed. Well, they said, should one deal with our sister like she was a harlot? She was a zana. Doesn't sound like that's quite a good enough excuse. So we're going to see later on that to the end of his life, Yaakov is still concerned with Levi and with Simeon and what they did on this particular day. All right, now at this point, Yaakov is going to hear from Elohim again. He's told, arise, go up to Beth-El. We remember Beth-El. Dwell there. Make an altar unto Elohim who appeared before you when you fled from before the face of Esau, your brother, first time, 22 plus years ago at this point. We're not sure how long he's been back. It's been a while. Yaakov then says to his house and all that were with him, all right, cleanse yourself from all of these fake Elohim, these strange gods that are among you. Purify yourself, change your garments. Let's arise, we'll head on up to Bethel, and I will make there an altar unto Elohim, who answered me in the day of my distress, and was with me the whole time that we've been roaming here. So they gave to their father Yaakov all of the foreign gods which were in their hands. Now remember, they had spoiled the city of Shechem, probably took a lot of gold and silver and other things, and no doubt among those were some fake idols, some things made of precious metals or whatever, so that might be why they kept them. And they also took the rings that were in their ears, and Yaakov took all of these things, buried them, hid them under the terebinth tree, which was right there at the city of Shechem. So they headed on up. They journeyed. And the terror of Elohim, it says, was upon the cities round about. And they did not pursue after the sons of Yaakov. So Jacob was worried about what was going to happen. And in fact, they were protected by Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh during this time. The terror of El was upon these other cities. Yaakov finally comes to Luz in the land of Canaan, same as Beth-El, he and all the people that were with him, and they built there an altar. They called the place El Beth-El, because that is where Elohim was revealed to him when he fled first time around from the face of his brother Esau. And here we're told Deborah, Rivka's nurse, finally died. And she was buried below Beth-El under the oak, and they called the name of that place Alon Bakut. And there again, Elohim appears to Yaakov when he came from Padan Aram, and he blessed him. And he said to Jacob, now this is the second time he's heard it, but I guess now we're hearing it not only in the form of a confirmation, right? The dream has been repeated, the vision, the statement has been repeated, so it's definitely confirmed in a second witness, and this time it's Elohim. And regardless of what Ish it might have been before, Scripture's now telling us, no doubt about it, your name is Yaakov. No longer it'll be called Yaakov, however, but Israel shall be your name. And he then called his name Israel. And then Elohim says to him, Ani, or in this case, Elohim, Ani El Shaddai. I am El Shaddai. It's translated as God Almighty. As you know, I like the All-Sufficient One, or sometimes just leave it in Hebrew, El Shaddai, one of the multiple names by which he is known. Be fruitful and multiply. There's the original command, repeated again. A nation and a company of nations will be of you. Kings will come out of your loins. And the land which I gave to your fathers, to Abraham and Isaac, to you I'll give it, and to your seed thereafter. So Elohim went up from him in the place where he spoke with him. Yaakov set up a pillar there, a pillar of stone. He poured out a drink offering and oil, and he called the name of the place, again, where Elohim spoke with him, Beth-El, House of El. And they headed on up from there. They journeyed from Beth-El, still some way to come to Ephrath. And Rachel, meanwhile, she travails. She has hard labor at this point. This is going to be her second son. But it came to pass when she was in hard labor that the midwife says to her, "Fear not, for this also is a son for you." Now, this is one of those things that, having read it over and over again, it clicks with me. We see fear not over and over again. I usually point out fear not is probably the most repeated commandment in Scripture. Angels say it. Elohim says it. The Word repeats it. Here is a midwife telling Rachel, fear not. And yet, the very next verse says, it came to pass that as her soul departed, because that's what happened, she died, that she called his name, the son that was born to her, and it was literally her last act, Ben-Oni, son of my sorrow, or son of my trouble. Father didn't like that name. He called him Ben-Yamin. We know that means the son of my right hand. But it is interesting, and I'll point it out this way. Rachel is dying. And yet still, I think there's a certain peace in hearing the commandment, fear not. She did give birth and name this son Ben-Oni. Father didn't keep it. Oftentimes the wife does name the son. In this case, he gets a better name, Ben-Yamin. Rachel died. She was buried there in the way to Ephrath. The place is called Bethlehem. House of bread. And Yaakov set up a pillar on her grave. That is the pillar of Rachel's grave still. And Israel journeyed, and he spread his tent beyond Migdal Eder. And it came to pass, while Israel dwelt in that land, that Reuben went and did something pretty nasty. Now, here is another one of those places where if you read the Midrash, you'll hear, oh, did he really, really do this? Maybe he just, it says he lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine. There are a couple ways to look at the Hebrew, but it seems like the implication here is pretty clear. He did something with his father's wife that he should not have done. And Yaakov, but in this case, it's called Israel. So his name, for the first time, in this segment, he's now called Israel several times. Israel journeyed, and Israel heard of it. Now, it says, the sons of Yaakov were 12. Interesting. Now, we're going to get the list of the names. But you have to ask, why is this here? Over and over again in Scripture, we're going to see when the 12 tribes of Israel are named, often, well, if we actually name all of the ones that could be included, since later, not here, but later on, we're going to see the story of Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. They get grafted in. They take the double portion place of the firstborn, and we have no shortage of reasons as we're going through this to see why that might be. But it does tell us that the sons of Yaakov were 12. And here we go. Sons of Leah, firstborn Reuben, Yaakov's firstborn. Simeon, Levi, Judah, and Issachar, and Zebulun, all the sons of Leah. Sons of Rachel, the one that we've had before, Yosef, and now the latest, Benjamin. Sons of Bilhah, Rachel's handmaid, Dan and Naphtali. The sons of Leah's handmaid, Zilpah, Gad, and Asher. These are the sons of Yaakov. They were born to him in Padan Aram. Yaakov then came to Isaac, his father, to Mamre, to Kiriat Arba, same as Hebron, where they his fathers, Abraham and Isaac, had sojourned. And now we're told, here is the father, Isaac, going to pass away. His days were 180 years. And he died. He was gathered unto his people, old and full of days, and Esau and Yaakov, his sons, buried him. So there's a long period of separation between Yaakov and his father. But at least now, as the days of Yitzhak are coming to an end, his sons are back together, and they're with him. Now, chapter 36, I'm going to go through this fairly rapidly and not necessarily name all of them. It is kind of interesting, and you do have to wonder, a lot of genealogy of the sons of Esau. Not necessarily the sons of promise, obviously. The same is Edom. So we know that the people that come from Esau are also called Edomites. We know that that references to the word red, and that there is a place that is kind of historically understood to be the place of the Edomites. We know that there are going to be a whole lot of issues with the Edomites over time, but that they still have an inheritance. We're also going to be reminded, remember, Esau took some wives that weren't pleasing to his mom and dad, daughters of Canaan. We're reminded of their names again. Ada, daughter of Elon the Hittite, Aholibamah, daughter of Anah, daughter of Zebion the Hivite, and Basemat, Ishmael's daughter, sister of Nebaioth. So he's got a number of women of the land, two daughters of Canaan, Hittites, and Hivites, and then, of course, one Basemat of the line of Ishmael. And now we're going to go through and hear all of the daughters and sons that were born to the various wives. Ada, she bore to Esau Eliphaz. Basemat bore Reuel. Aholibamah bore Yeush, Yalam, and Korah. These are the sons of Esau, born to him in the land of Canaan. Now, Esau took his wives, his sons, his daughters, and he gathered everything that he had up in the land of Canaan, and he went away into a land far away from his brother Yaakov. Similar to what we saw with Lot and Abraham, because their substance was too great for them to sojourn together, and the land literally couldn't bear all of their wealth, all of their cattle and goats and sheep and so forth. So Esau dwelt in the mountain land of Seir and Ir. Again, Esau, we're told, that mountain land is Edom. And here are the generations of Esau, the father of the Edomites in the mountain land. Names of his sons, Eliphaz, Reuel, and then they have their sons of Eliphaz, a whole bunch, Teman, Omar, Zepho, Gatam, Kenaz. We hear about a concubine to Eliphaz, and she bore him a son. Now, this one, I guess, is worthy of note, because we're going to see that this name kind of has a nasty ring throughout history. So, we got Eliphaz. She bears sons, Teman, Omar, Zepho, Gatam, and Kenaz. And Timnah was a concubine to Eliphaz, Esau's son. And she bore Eliphaz Amalek. These are the sons of the first wife, Ada. And here we have the sons of Reuel, and I won't go through the names of all of them, except for a few. Okay, when we get to the chiefs of the sons of Esau, sons of Eliphaz, firstborn of Esau, the chief, Teman, we've talked about him, chief of Omar, chief of Zepho, chief of Kenaz, the chief of Korah, the chief of Gatam, and the chief of Amalek. These are the chiefs that came out of Eliphaz of the Edomites, the sons of Ada. Then we go through the others of the sons and the progenitors of all of the Edomites. Let's see. Down through the lines of the chiefs, about verse 29, these are the chiefs that came out of the Horites, chief of Lotan, of Shobal, chief of Zebion, chief of Anah, chief of Dishon, Ezer, and Dishan. These are the chiefs that came out of the Horites, according to the chiefs in the land of Seir. And then we're told this in this next verse. Here then are the kings that reigned in the land of Edom, the kings of the Edomites. And this, it notes, was before there reigned any king over the children of Israel. Think about that for a second. We know centuries down the line, we're going to find a time and a place where the people in Israel during the time of the judges eventually say, give us king like all the other nations, the nations around about. Well, is it just possible, after all, we've got these Edomite kings that have been around for a long time, that the descendants of the kings we're talking about here are among those that they're saying, hey, give us king like all these other kings. And that does make sense. The last verse then in this chapter finally says the following. These, after listing the entire genealogy of the first several generations after Esau, the father of the Edomites, says, these are the chiefs of Edom, according to their habitations in the land of their possession, in the land of Edom. This is Esau, the father of the Edomites. So there we go. And with that, of course, that takes us to the end of the Parsha. So we have Yaakov returning. We have a battle that could have been, but wasn't. Thankfully, there was reconciliation. We then see the unfortunate incident with Dinah and the reason why Shechem was destroyed. Shechem the town and Shechem the individual. We see why it is that Yaakov heads back north, and there are some seeds planted of division among the sons. And things that their father, years later, is still going to remember and criticize them for. And then, of course, we see the generations that follow Esau himself, the chief and the firstborn among those that are later called Edomites and their line of kings.